You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to help you stop counting calories, carbs, and fat grams so you can easily get to a healthy weight and get on with your life. That is what it is all about. I want you to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. If you want to call in and talk with me today, the number is 323-203-0815. I would love to hear what is on your mind, what is weighing on you, because the real problem with binge eating, stress eating, any kind of emotional eating, the real problem is not food. The problem is what is eating at you. Okay, so let's talk about Zoom dysmorphia. I just wrote an article for Psychology Today on Zoom dysmorphia, and I wanted to share it with you because I think maybe you can relate. Even if you don't have all-out dysmorphia, there might be something about this that is going to resonate with you. Okay, so what is Zoom dysmorphia and why does it hurt so much? I can't stand to look at myself, said Britt, positioning a post-it over her image on the computer screen. My nose is huge, Ben winced. It's distracting to see that all day long. Sometimes it's all I can think about in meetings. If you can relate to Britt or Ben, you are not alone. During the COVID-19 quarantine, the only way to see others was to connect on Zoom or other virtual platforms. And so video conferencing, social events, even video dating became the norm. And for some people, this increased FaceTime created a lot of distress. Many of us, most of us, have occasional insecurities about our appearance. We might have a bad hair day. We might think a photo was taken from a bad angle. Being self-conscious is different from the crippling anxiety of body dysmorphic disorder, which is a mental health condition that's similar to obsessive compulsive disorder. But Zoom dysmorphia refers to a type of body dysmorphia known as facial dysmorphia. And those people who suffer from this condition scrutinize their noses, skin, teeth, ears, other aspects of their faces, fixating on what they think they need to change and actually avoiding social interactions. Seeing themselves on a computer screen is like looking into a funhouse mirror and believing that the distorted image reflects reality. So here are some signs of Zoom dysmorphia. Anxiety about attending video meetings with your camera on. Attempting to look perfect before video calls. Focusing on your on-screen appearance and finding flaws. And believing that other people are also focused on these perceived flaws. So from a psychoanalytic perspective, the origins of dysmorphia go back to the earliest stages of development during what's called the mirror stage. And that's when babies see themselves reflected in their parents. So when parents are warm and loving, babies feel loved and lovable. And if you've ever seen a parent with a baby, if it's going well, you know, that baby is being held in the parent's arms and the parent's looking at the baby with such look of love and the baby sees the love and feels lovable. They're being mirrored. However, when there is no reliable and consistently loving gaze, or when there's consistent indifference or absence, babies cannot internalize a sense of themselves as appealing and lovable. And instead, they may feel rejected, humiliated. So our sense of self, the way we think about ourselves, is very much influenced by what we see or don't see in the eyes of others very early on. In fact, Donald Winnicott wrote, "The mother is looking at the baby, and what she looks like is related to what she sees there." Pretty intense, right? He wrote that in 1971. The mother is looking at the baby, and what she looks like is related to what she sees there. So people with dysmorphia feel intense shame. And that is, you know, shame is the painful idea that there's something fundamentally wrong with you. Shame carries with it the expectation of rejection or the withdrawal of love. So focusing on your appearance is a way of managing shame. The idea is that if you can change the way you look, or if you can conceal these perceived deficits, you will change the way other people relate to you. You will change the way they think about you. So to do this, you first have to see what you need to hide. Phil Mullen, a writer who in 2002 says, "The mirror is scrutinized to ensure that no untoward, uncontrolled, or embarrassing aspects of the person are in evidence." So the Zoom screen has become a modern day mirror, and one that we all peer in much more often than ever before. So a patient who I'm going to call Lindsay, she often reported that she felt ugly, quote unquote, ugly. And she was astonished to learn that ugly was not in fact a feeling. She recalled being a small child and watching her beautiful but depressed mother get ready for a night out. And after Lindsay put lipstick on herself, her mother sharply told her she looked like a clown. She just really shamed her. And Lindsay interpreted that moment and many similar interactions as meaning she was not pretty enough. She was too ugly to love. She imagined that I also experienced her as hideous. So Lindsay and I explored how ugly was code for the shame of failing to make her mother happy, failing to lift her mother out of her depression. And by working through the pain of those past experiences, Lindsay was able to release these ugly feelings and see herself anew, see herself actually as she was, without the filter of this, the ugliness of the feelings that became the ugly her. So just as Lindsay thought I was totally repulsed by her appearance, people with dysmorphia are convinced that everyone is scrutinizing and criticizing the way they look. This can be understood as the projection of their own harsh perspective of themselves onto other people. So in this case, projection means attributing your own thoughts to others. So coworkers, family, friends, even strangers are experienced as looking at you through your own judgmental eyes. Your criticisms become their criticisms of you. It's emotional torture. So treating any kind of dysmorphia, including Zoom dysmorphia, means turning shame into self-acceptance. And therapy can give you a new experience. It actually gives you what Heinz Kohut called a mirror transference. So in treatment, patients have a different experience with their therapists than with their original caregivers. They get mirrored by their therapist, gives them a new experience. And when you are deeply understood and reflected in therapy, those earlier ruptures and deprivations are replaced with a new foundation for self-esteem. That's why therapy works. It's not just about insight. It's certainly not about insight. Insight is only a tiny part of it. We have to actually experience something different. And when you have ruptures in your life that come from relationships, a therapeutic relationship can be extremely healing. So just as the origins of dysmorphia are in the early parent-child relationship, healing also takes place in a relationship. When Lindsay internalized my warm and accepting view of her, she slowly began to experience herself as acceptable and likable and stopped feeling ugly. We live in an age when to be physically acceptable is often the only way to feel good enough. Isn't that sad? Wait, I'm going to stick to the article I wrote. Okay. Zoom dysmorphia highlights the deficits in self-esteem that exist in so many of us. And to create change, we must journey within ourselves, optimally led by an interested guide, like a therapist, who can help us discover ways to soothe, love, and appreciate ourselves. Healing the past and shifting our thoughts will transform the way we see ourselves, literally and figuratively. So that is my article on Zoom dysmorphia, and you could, I'm sure that many of you can resonate with what it feels like to not feel good enough and think if only you change the way you look, you're going to be good enough. If only you change the way you look, people will like you, people will love you, people will want you. You'll have more friends, you'll have more of whatever it is that you're missing if you change your body. This is that illusion that if you change your body, you change your life. And it is also a sense of overinvestment in our bodies as ourselves. You are more than your body, and to be against your body means to constantly be in attack mode. But when you sense that your body is a part of you, you can take a lot better care of it. It's easier to take care of it, of her or him, as some people now start to say. Again, if you would like to join me, if you have any questions, any comments, the number here is 323-203-0815. Love to hear from you. Oh, and the other thing, again, I want to highlight from the article is the idea that, you know, that if when we have ugly feelings, we feel like we're ugly. When we have, we feel bad, we often think we look bad. And when we feel bad, we often learn to attack ourselves or to abandon ourselves instead of we feel bad. That's the time to be most with yourself. That's the time to take your own side, to give yourself the most comfort, the most love. Think about if a friend or someone you love felt bad, you wouldn't say, just get over it. At least I hope not. You wouldn't say, here, have a cookie. Eat some pizza. Just stop that. You would talk to your friend about what was going on. That's the way to be with yourself. You have to talk to you. Okay. So again, 323-203-0815. Give me a call. Now, someone in my Dr. Nina's Food for Thought community, I think her name is Dahlia, I don't remember exactly, asked a question about over-explaining. And so I did a little research on over-explaining and found a couple of articles I would like to share with you because it is a common thing to, do I have a caller?
Good morning.
Ah, there is my caller. Hi, Carly Gash. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you today?
I am doing really well, thank you.
So I was listening to your article, and I can relate to that. I learned to overcome Zoom dysmorphia during pandemic through your work and talking to myself. Just saying that it is how it is, and I don't have to give in to those voices. And at the same time, I still have this dysmorphia on recording myself as I sing, and I always wanted to sing. You know, it's very easy for me to sing, create things, create content. It's nothing for me. But when I do it, I kind of look at myself and I judge myself so harshly. That I actually never do this. So yesterday I'm still in San Francisco. Yesterday, I went to to see Golden Gate. I was in such a good mood. And I went to their restroom and it had perfect lighting. And I said, I need to record some singing piece because one guy is asking for my vocal example for the band. And I started recording and I started immediately criticizing harshly the way I sing, the way my face looks, because I have this a little asymmetrical face. And so when I talk, one part of my mouth is more lower or higher. I guess
by the way, that's every human on the planet. That's everybody. Mm-hmm. Nobody speaks with complete symmetry.
Yes. So, see, that's the distortion I have. For some reason, when I look at others, it's okay for them to be this way, and I don't even notice, actually. And when it comes to me, it's all this harshness, especially when it comes to, talent, my talent. And back then, I'm actually tracing it back to when I was in musical school, I had this solfeggio teacher. She had a really terrible voice, honestly, but that's not the case. She's there to teach us notes and stuff, theoretical stuff. So she's not supposed to sing. I had a beautiful voice. And when I used to sing, she was just hostile to me in general, She was very bad to me. I assume she was racist too, because I could feel the attitude. I don't know. It's just, or maybe whenever, I don't know. She just hated me and always, she never said any good thing to me. She would say things yes, you are talented. You have a great amount of talent, actually the biggest, but it's all hard work. You're doing nothing. So don't even count on your talent to pull you up, because it's the art is about hard work and only 5% of talent. So don't you ever even think that you're going to succeed with your solely your talent, because you need to do work
whatever. Would you say that you then internalized, not only did you internalize the harsh relationship of your family to you, which in the many times that you've called, we know that every time you say so or see, something mean is going to come out in this mean tone. Would you say you also internalized this attitude of this teacher?
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Nina, I need to say that, unfortunately, when I was in my family and I was treated badly, somehow I guess, I formed my personality back then as a kid to fit that traumatized and distorted family. And I made myself in this sort of people pleaser, my head always shrinking in my shoulders, or on the contrary, being too bold, inviting the fight, as that's what was my dynamic in the family. So, and because I had this personality, I just think that others, teachers or whoever adults surrounding me, those who had troubles themselves, they just reacted the same way as my family did. So not all the teachers were like that. And particularly my musical school teachers, almost all of them were like that. I don't know why. They just hated me for my talent, Because
Carly Gash, your voice is a little bit hard to hear. I don't know if you're on speaker or... just a little bit hard to hear you clearly.
Is it better now?
Say something.
Can you hear me better now? I'm off speaker now.
Yes, that is much better.
Thank you for your patience.
Yeah.
So I guess when I had this, was treated so badly and hostile by my family, I developed adjusted my personality to fit this distorted family dynamic. And then when I went out to school or somewhere else, I guess I would just being that person, who adjusted to my family and exercising the same behavior. So when there were teachers out there who were a little bit like my family or like in the same dynamic, they would react the same way. And it's very interesting because whenever I go, my work or anywhere, I kind of end up creating that dynamic. And honestly, I'm so tired of it.
Okay, so how does this relate to food when you are not getting reflected well, when you are not feeling as if you are seen and appreciated and acknowledged and validated, even if you're being helped and guided and even if you're learning something or being corrected, if you don't feel that you are seen and appreciated, it leaves an emptiness within you, an emptiness in your soul, which then can symbolically be filled with food. When we feel empty, we don't want to feel empty. We want to feel full of, you know, love. If we can't take in love, we can't take in acknowledgement. We take in a representation of that, which is food. And it's really important to recognize how these deficits in relationships impact your relationship with yourself and impact your relationship with food.
This is very interesting because I definitely used food to all the things you were talking about every time on the radio show and in your programs. I used food to numb my feelings, to escape my own mean voice. I used food to soothe and comfort myself, for I lacked soothing and comforting words. I used food to fill the void. I used food to...
can you speak up? I'm so sorry. It's really hard to hear you.
It's okay. Maybe this connection is not very good, so...
It's better. I think you just need to speak up. Because I think when you start talking, your voice kind of drops down or maybe away from the phone. But, you know, you're saying you use food for so many different ways.
Yeah, so definitely I used food in I would say in all of those ways. I would say, Dr. Nina, it's so interesting. I would never even think that life that some people in the world have it in their lives, you know, relationships, fulfillment. I remember when I was a kid, I had fulfillment, but it was more like from my natural character, and then it kind of faded. So I could not even imagine how life could be when you have like loving people around you, the job which motivates you and excites you, or like, if not all of them, but at least some of them going, like the main ones. So, and I guess I just always used food. So for me right now, the work I'm doing is totally new. It's like as if I was born a baby and I'm again learning how to experience things, but I'm building those experiences like from the healthy, effective perspective, like, you know, instead of isolating and using food, I'm just going to another city, trying things or talking to people. Or when, you know, isolation came to the point when people called me or I talked to a friend, they just irritate me because they start right away complaining about their things. And I'm like, I immediately start judging them or like just being angry how I'm tired of listening to every other people's problems. And then I would just say, I cannot just be so harsh to my friends because like nobody's perfect. People are doing their best. And
so that's a way to be. That's the way to be with yourself. You're catching yourself being somewhat harsh with your friends. Got to catch yourself being somewhat harsh with yourself and be more reasonable. Give yourself some comfort words. When you give yourself comfort words, less, you don't need comfort food.
Got it. Yeah. And honestly, I need to say that's a progress on my side. So now when I overeat, I feel very, very bad. I try to do it less and less, but not because I'm like dieting. I just I do my best to recognize what's going on. And if I couldn't like manage and I overread to deal with emotions, I feel so bad after it that I also feel like kind of compassion to myself for just seeing the whole situation that I feel terrible in the first place because of my past experiences, unfortunate traumatic experiences. And I'm still in the process of learning. And of course, I have this kind of slips. And then I'm situations when I'm in physical pain.
Carly Gash, it's not what you are eating, it's why. It's, you know, I'm stopping you because I think you made an important point and you just were kind of continuing. And I want to bring it to, I want to really highlight that. It's not what you're eating that is the problem, it's why. And when you realize you are eating to fill a void, to comfort yourself when you're sad, to eating things that remind you of home, eating for loneliness, eating for punishment, eating to you are in physical pain because that converts emotional pain to physical pain. When you realize that and you are able to have a different way of relating with yourself, then everything changes.
It actually works, and I'm very grateful to you, Dr. Nina. And I want to tell to all the listeners out there who may be like doing your program or in the very beginning, and sometimes, you know, in the beginning it feels like, oh my God, I felt it's just so many of those triggers. Oh my God, it's just millions and millions. I will be 80 when I manage all of them. But you know, when I started doing them, they kind of repetitive. And whenever it's going on, like I either overeating or have an urge to overeat, I ask like what's going on. And it's always something, like you said, I'm either missing home or I'm cold. Or like I'm in a new environment and my like traumatic PTSD like flashbacks are like firing. But like I would say I'm learning to like notice it, and it's not as scary as it used to be, honestly. It used to put me in the panic because I couldn't even orient myself or make sense of what's going on. Right now, it's more like I feel what's going on better. So it gives me more understanding and control, and eventually fear subsides. Sometimes I'm like right now, I just left the gym in San Francisco. First time I had like sauna and gym after pandemic. And I was rushing to hear your, radio show. And I went out and I'm like, I'm going to eat. But then I'm like, what's going on? I was just uncomfortable because I didn't have my yoga stuff. Not usual, because whatever I had in my car, I just used them. I'm in another city. And then I said, I don't have to because I'm pretty full. And I just need to listen to Dr. Nina's show. And yes, that's work I'm doing. Sometimes I want to avoid it because it's uncomfortable, but it's okay. I can do it. It's just slowly reprogramming my brain from this trauma, recognizing, and that's the best way. And, you know, I sat in my car, and instead of binging, I said, oh, I'm actually thirsty, that's the thing. I drank a little bit water, I felt fine, and I started listening to your show. So sometimes it's like that, sometimes I overeat, and I would say overall it's a very positive dynamic, and I'm very, very happy about it. So thank you very much.
Thank you for sharing your experience and your progress and letting me know and us know of your shift. And I definitely hear a completely different way that you are talking about yourself and talking to yourself. And I hear you pausing and thinking, why? Instead of acting on, I have to eat, I want to eat. Why? Why do I want to eat? So you're being curious, not critical. And that's wonderful. So good for you, Carly Gash. I'm really happy to hear this.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nina. Have a wonderful day, and hi to all the listeners. Take care.
Okay. Bye, Carly Gash. Yeah, it's amazing when you start getting interested in why you're doing what you're doing instead of focusing just on what you're doing. That's harder. it's a lot easier to be on a diet or focus on food or focus on counting calories, carbs, macros, or whatever. It's a lot easier to do that than it is to say, God, what's eating at me? Why am I focusing on food right now? Why am I tearing myself apart? It looks like I have another caller. No.
Hi, Dr. Nina.
Yes. It's Josh. Hi, Josh.
Yeah. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
Good. I've been reading a book. I mean, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but I mentioned it in Instagram, and I said that personality disorders are maybe somehow remotely linked to eating disorders.
No,
and you
no.
didn't seem to agree.
No, I think that there for a while it was thought that that people with borderline personality disorder had higher incidence of eating disorders. This is sort of old thinking, and I think that it pathologizes a coping mechanism and ties it to a personality disorder rather than it is a disorder of yearning, it is a disorder of relating to oneself, it is a disorder of it's a deleterious coping mechanism. So I haven't read the book. You say that it's called Borderline Bodies. It might have to do with how some people with borderline personality disorder turn to food, but I do think that this is somewhat old thinking, and it's no longer thought that people with eating disorders have a personality are more likely to have a personality disorder. You know, so that's my
thought. Yeah, I mean, it's just an interesting book. I'm reading it. I was just going to say that it's just so interesting how you started the show. You know, the image we have of our bodies, the bodies, who knows what they actually look like, first of all. No one knows who anyone looks like ever. You know, I mean, you know, not only are we always changing, but who has the right angle, you know? I mean, but I feel like that's really linked to not personality, but it's linked to food for sure. I think definitely in me, it's got to be linked to food. And I just feel like if there is a personality disturbance, I wouldn't be surprised because trauma can create all sorts of disturbances, you know, beyond just eating disorders.
Yes, but to tie eating disorders to personality disorders creates a false equation. And I think that it is also very pathologizing. People with eating disorders struggle because they have a difficulty relating with themselves. Might some of them have borderline personality disorder? Yes, but that exists in our culture, that exists in our society. So I think that making that leap of tying those two together pathologizes eating disorders and is not a good way to talk about people who struggle with eating disorders. That's why I say I don't treat eating disorders, I treat people. And people develop eating disorders for reasons that are as unique as they are. And it's really important to look at eating disorders as a deleterious coping mechanism. Like I said before, it is a way of trying to help yourself that also hurts you. It's a way of managing loss of love, pain, discomfort, you name it, through food. It does so many things for you, which of course I discuss every week on the show. But I really, really, really want to make clear, it doesn't mean you have a personality disorder if you struggle with food. That is just not an equation that is real or appropriate to make. So it sounds like the title of the book has to do with people who actually have borderline personality disorder and their relationship with food rather than some people with borderline personality disorder have eating disorders, but not everyone with an eating disorder has a personality disorder.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that she said that, because I think that would be my misunderstanding of her entire research project, in her book. So, but for me, I just thought it was interesting that she did mention how she thought the construct was similar. But let's not go there, because I don't even want to make that connection, because you're absolutely right. Why would we be doing that? That would be a terrible thing to do. And I'm not saying she's doing it. I'm actually saying she's not doing it. I'm doing it. So I just want to make that very clear. But anyway, beyond that, I would just say that I think it's interesting if, we have some issue with our appearance that could be linked to our parents, how they saw us, like your quote of Winnicott, saying that how the mother looks means that the child must be like that. And I think that's so interesting, because how much have we imbibed of our parents that are making us think that we look bad on a Zoom call because our parent gave us a weird face sometime, that's obviously going on. I think your brilliant paper, your article was suggesting that it could have something to do with our upbringing.
It always has something to do with our upbringing or something that happened in the past. And it's not about, oh, this happened. It's about how did what happened in the past affect your present? It's not like, oh, that happened and my mom called me a clown. It's about, oh, her mom called her a clown. Her mom was also depressed. Her mom couldn't relate to her. But she got the message that she was sort of a burden and a joke and uninteresting and all of that. And she took that interpretation as reality and how that affected her. It felt ugly. And then she became ugly in her own mind. So it's how we interpret things that happen. Sometimes we have parents who are depressed, and Andre Green calls depressed, well, he talks about mothers. Unfortunately, psychoanalysts talk way too much about mothers and not enough about fathers that affect us. The dead mother, and how having a depressed mother affects kids. When you have a depressed mother, you can't internalize this like enlivened, loving, colorful, sort of good, warm, alive feeling. People can't connect to someone who's depressed and feels sort of dead, so they may internalize an emptiness. Depressed people don't know how to, they don't have the wherewithal to take care of their kids. Their kids then don't say, mom's depressed and she has no ability to take care of me right now because she's going through something. Kids say, what's wrong with me? That I must not be enough. I must not deserve it. There must be something wrong with me. I must be ugly. If only I could be beautiful, then she would have that gleam in her eye when she looks at me. I mean, people can take it so many different ways. Or dad is looking at me like, ugh, he's so disgusted. I must be disgusting. So these are the interpretations that people make and then take as realities that then affect their relationship with themselves and other people. And food, because if you don't have a safe, trusting bond with other people, if you can't fill up on relationship, you will turn to food or use food in some way. Anorexia is turning against needs, not just about food. Binge eating is filling an emptiness, or can be. Bulimia is both. I want so much, I hate that I want it. I'm going to get rid of my needs. So, all of which is to say, yes, Josh, you're absolutely right. What happens in the past has everything to do with how we interpret ourselves, our likability, our lovability, and our trust or mistrust in relationship.
Yeah, that was really beautiful what you just said. I think it just, I just want to listen to that again and again and again, because, you know, the connection is everything, but it's not as if, like you said, we need to dwell on the past as if it's something that we can never overcome, right?
Exactly. People misperceive this idea of talking about the past. And people will come to me and they'll say, I've been in therapy for 30 years and I've talked about the past. The past is over. I want to talk about the future. But they've never talked about the past as it pertains to their present. They've talked about, like, this thing happened. Let's mourn it. Let's grieve it. That was terrible. They don't look at this thing happened. And as a result of that happening, you learned or interpreted these ideas about yourself, which you took into the present. Or you don't look at it like, okay, you had a critical, judgmental grandparent, and it really affected you. So now you kind of, unbeknownst to you, you're trying to resolve that early relationship by going to critical, judgmental people and trying to win them over, right? There's often not a bridge between what happened in the past and what's happening in the present. And that's the important key piece.
Yeah. And generally speaking, I mean, a child who would ever go against the grain of a parent was faced with complete abandonment. I mean, there's no way to really argue in a real true sense with a parent when you're very, very young. So no matter what occurred, in some way, you had to agree with maybe what you didn't at all want to agree with, just out of a fear of basically being totally left, you know, to your own defenses as a defenseless child. I mean, it's very difficult.
Well, kids do not have the wherewithal to say, something's up with my parents, like mom's depressed or dad's upset because he's got, lost his job. And all they know is I'm getting yelled at, or I'm not getting responded to, or all they know is how they're being treated. And then kids don't say, oh, something's up with my parents. Kids say, what's wrong with me that my parents are treating me this way? What's wrong with me? Which gives them the illusion for hope. Oh, if I could just figure out what's wrong with me and make myself good, then I'm going to get the kind of relating that I need. Only there was anything wrong with them, so that hope becomes a conviction that there's something wrong with them. That is shame.
Yeah. And then I think we try to cure our parents, because if we're not saying that there's something wrong with us, we're saying, well, I can cure my dad if I just listen to what he's saying and go along with what he's doing, even though I might be incurring trauma just by even thinking that way. We try to be the caretakers, and our parents can recruit us to make them feel better. I mean, can they not?
Some people, everyone's different. So some people are parentified children and they have to take care of their parents. And instead of getting taken care of, they end up taking care of mom and dad, or mom or dad, or, you know, both of them. And that's called, you know, parentified child. And then often people who come to me, they have taken care of their parents, and then they go through life taking care of everybody else, and food takes care of them. So they have no needs. They don't ask anything of anybody, but they deplete themselves to take care of other people, and food takes care of them. That's some people. Everyone's an individual, but that's a common thing for people.
Yeah. I mean, how do you separate dad's history from the innocent child who's just a perfect little boy or girl?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, the question is how do you separate what dad is bringing to the equation from his past, potentially, and the innocence and life and love that the child is unknowingly present. And how would the adult be able to separate, you know, in other words, how would I be able to separate what my dad was bringing into our, the relationship I had with him as a infant versus what I'm just there being, you know, an innocent person, you know, an innocent boy in the relationship being sort of burdened with whatever it is that the father was was bringing to the relationship.
Well, this is first you have to have insight of, okay, what happened, what actually were just factually happened versus how did you interpret what happened? Because different people have different interpretations. If you have I'm making this up, workaholic dad doesn't have much time for his kids. One kid's going to say, I hate dad because he's always working. One kid's going to say, what's wrong with me that dad likes work better than spending time with me? There must be something wrong with me. You know, another kid's going to have a different interpretation. So it's recognizing, well, okay, what was happening? Dad's working all the time. Another kid might say, dad just doesn't want to be with mom. Like, you know, I mean, so it just depends on the interpretation. So I want to look at what happened and then how did you interpret that? And look at how the interpretation has influenced your ideas about yourself and the world now. So I hope right. that helps.
I hope that helps.
Actually, we're sort of over time. So unfortunately I have to end, but Josh, please call me back next week and let's continue this, this dialogue, because it's a really important question. It's, you know, how we interpret things. Perception is reality. How we interpret things affects how we feel and what we expect in the future.
Yeah, and I'll just end by saying most likely the interpretation was wrong. Otherwise, why speak to a psychoanalyst, right? It must be wrong interpretation for the child. But anyway, thank you very much.
And it's not about being wrong, it's about being painful, right? It is wrong, but kids are egocentric, so kids always blame themselves. So instead of, that's the wrong interpretation, you did the best you could, given the fact that you were an innocent little boy and no one was having a conversation with you about how you felt or was attuned to you or whatever, so you just came up with your own narrative. And then that narrative became reality. So I look forward to continuing.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you so much. Yes.
You are welcome. Before I go, I'll speak to you next week, Josh, I hope. Thank you, Josh and Carly Gash, who called today. I really appreciate your openness and willingness to share your thoughts and your lives and your conflicts and your triumphs also. And before I go, I just want to say this is the last time that Ronan, my engineer, my wonderful engineer of over 4 years, he is leaving LA Talk Radio. So this is our last time with Ronan. And Ronan, you deserve the big crowd applause because you have just been amazing and wonderful. And I will miss you so much. So, Ronan, I wish you well as you move forward. Everybody else, thank you so much for joining me here today on LA Talk Radio and Instagram. I am here every Wednesday at LA Talk Radio and Instagram at 11 a.m. Pacific. You can also listen later on Apple Podcasts or anywhere where you get podcasts. If you like the show, please take a moment and leave a rating or a review, because the more people who rate and review the show, the more it shows up in searches, the more I can help other people, the more that we can help. It's a joint effort. And Ronan, I know you can't see Instagram, but people are saying thank you from Carla Gash, from from Sharon, from some other people. So thank you. Thank you, Ronan. Thank you, listeners. Have a wonderful week, and I'll see you next week. Bye for now.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.